a postdoc, that'd be nice. Or maybe like a postdoc, that'd also be nice. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is, Hamiltonian formulation of the Big Hail conjecture. This is work that's been carried out at Penn State in collaboration with Vyashkathar and Adam Henderson. And there's a recent paper that's gone up on the archive down there at the bottom. Do you guys have a point or anything? I need my arms, it's okay.
No, there's an office seat right there.
Oh, fantastic. You know you're in Canada. this is brilliant. Okay, so it's a recent paper up on the archive, and it's going to appear in CQG next month. It should appear there eventually. Okay, the paper we've got up at the moment is just a letter. It's an overview, and there'll be much more detailed papers coming out for a given volume shortly. Okay, so first I want to talk about why we study singularities. And I realize to an extent I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, because, people are interested in singularities. However, what I want to tell you is that singularities are a generic feature of general relativity. Now, initially, this was something that now we take for granted, but a long time ago, when singularities were first seen, people weren't quite sure whether they were a general feature or whether they were artifacts that were caused by the symmetries imposed in the system. So when we had our first singularities, way back when, we had the Schwarzschild solution and so on, you had people, particularly the Russian groups in Moscow, wanted to believe that, in fact, these singularities were just an artifact that were being created because we had imposed symmetries on our system that might not, and these things might not be borne out in much more general models. However, fortunately for us, Penrose came along and proved his singularity theorems, and he managed to show that under very, very general conditions that singularities do exist in general relativity. Now, the Penrose singularity theorems are remarkable pieces of mathematics. Unfortunately, they don't really help us very much with the physics, because they tell us that singularities exist, and not much else beyond that, really. Beyond knowing that they're there, that geodesics are going to terminate somewhere, we don't really know very much about what goes on at a singularity. So, they're fascinating things to study. And in this way, I want to say that general relativity actually predicts its own demise. Okay? What I mean by this is singularities point us to regions of the theory, limits of the theory, where GR is telling us, what I believe it's trying to tell us, is don't trust me here, okay? When curvatures get incredibly large, where you have singularities, this is where the physical theorem itself is breaking down and saying, no, you need a more fundamental theory here. And I believe this is a hallmark of a really good theory of physics. It should not only tell you stuff that's new, it should not only reproduce old results, but if it gives you for free a way of seeing where you want to find new physics, so singularities act as a probe of new physics, it's a really, really positive thing to have come out of your theory. And of course, singularities are essential for understanding cosmology. So here we have a standard picture of, standard cartoon, really, of cosmology. We start with the Big Bang, we go through a period of inflation. This bit's a little bit dodgy with some people, but let's assume it's there for now. And then we go through surface of light scattering, recombination, etc., galaxies form, eventually get to roughly today. And the part I want to really talk about right now is I want to talk about this little area in red here. Okay, so really we're getting right down to the Planck regime. We're approaching the singularity itself. Okay, so a little bit of introduction here. Now, loop quantum cosmology has been a recent fantastic advance. We've got from the audience here, which is really nice to have. And we see that the Big Bang singularity is actually replaced by a bounce in the homogeneous and isotropic models. These are the FRW models. We see that what used to be a bang is now a bounce. And this is something that's a really interesting prediction from loop quantum cosmology, but this certainly isn't the end of the story, and we certainly don't know if this is true. The singularity resolution, what we'd like to know is this a feature of full loop quantum gravity, or again, is it an artifact of the symmetries we've imposed? So if we step away from the homogeneous and isotropic models, are we going to see this bounce persist, or is it just a fluke? Okay? And this is something we really want to investigate, because we want to know whether loop quantum gravity really does resolve singularities. In fact, Karam asked this question on the archive a couple of days ago. Are loop quantum cosmologies never singular? thanks for asking, your check's in the mail, Carl. We don't know yet, and so we would like to find out as much information about moving away from these models as we can. So to do this, we need to quantize more general models. We want to look at the Bianchi models, Gaudi models, G2 models, any model really, any model of cosmology that has a singularity. We want to be able to see if we can probe the physics at the singularity and see whether or not we see singularity resolution coming in here. Okay? And there is a growing amount of numerical and analytical evidence that cosmological singularities are described very well by this conjecture of Bilinski, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz. And I will talk a little bit more about that in a short while. Okay, so I should tell you what this conjecture actually states. The idea is this. The spatial derivatives in the equations of motion will become negligible, in a certain sense, as we approach the singularity. So the idea is that in Einstein's equations, we have a system of partial differential equations, we have space-like derivatives, and we have time-like derivatives, and what we want to say is that in every equation where you see a space-like derivative, there are other terms that dominate this. Okay? The second part is that matter doesn't matter. Okay? The effects of most type of matter become negligible near the singularity, and so it's good enough to study mostly vacuum solutions. Okay? There are serious exceptions to this. The case of a stiff fluid or a scalar field or photons, for example, does break this. But most types of matter, thus radiation, their effects become negligible for singularity. And finally, the idea is that the dynamics near the singularity, the classical dynamics, is of the mixed master type. That is a sequence of Bianchi 1 cosmologies separated, or almost Bianchi 1, I should say, separated by transitions which take the form of Bianchi 2 cosmology. Okay. So what are we going to do? We're going to get a truncated theory. So what we're going to do is we're going to take our full theory of GR, we're going to make a truncation by neglecting spatial derivatives, and we're going to make the assumption that this will give us a good approximation of the dynamics as we get close to the singularity. What we want to say is that we're going to make the assumption that a quantization of this truncated theory is probably going to be an important step towards proving that general cosmological singularities are resolved. Or, on the flip side, if we find that in these, if we find that in this truncated system the singularity is not resolved, well then we have a result, we have a counter example of this singularity resolution. So really, this could go either way. And it would be very interesting, and I'm very excited to see what actually happens. And finally, what we want to really is a way to describe this conjecture, because everything we have here is fairly vague and hand-wavy at this point. We want a way to describe this conjecture and truncate the theory in a way that's suitable for quantization. Okay, so here's a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the motivated variables for the system. I'm going to talk about a truncated theory and the truncated dynamics. If I still have time and you guys haven't asked me enough questions, I'll go on and talk about the phenomenology. Let me get to this part because the rest are some pretty cool pictures here. And then finally, I will come to some conclusions. Okay, so first let me introduce the chasm of space-time. This is the Bianchi 1 vacuum solution. It takes this form. Ds squared is minus d tau squared plus tau to the kappa 1 dx squared, etc. Subject to the constraints that these kappas sum to 1 and the sum of the squares is 1, for these kappas are real. We see that there is one true degree of freedom in the system. If you look at these two constraints, we've got two constraints, three variables, one solution. Geometrically, you can see this as being the intersection of a plane with a sphere. Okay, so this results in what we call a chasm circle. Okay, we can parameterize this by one value. This value is not equal to u. That parameterizes where you are in this chasm circle. To say it's the homogeneous vacuum solution, it's homogeneous but anisotropic. Okay, so we can pick out specific directions, but we can't pick out special points. And we find that this space-time itself, this solution, is unstable under perturbations. So if you hand me a Bianchi 1 solution, and you make a tiny perturbation away from being of this form, say you put a dx dy term that can't reproduce back to this, you will find that this quickly evolves away from being the solution. Okay. So if you give me a slice on which we are approximately Bianchi 1, slightly away, you will find that this actually transitions and moves away from here. But we can bring it back to being a stable solution by adding in a stiff fluid. The effect of adding in a stiff fluid of our scalar field is to this side, this constraint here, you get a momentum conjugate to the scalar field, like pi squared over here. The effect of this geometrically is that it reduces the radius of the sphere that intersects the plane, and so you get this circle shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. Now, to solve these two constraints, you'll notice that one of the k's, when the capital, sorry, has to be negative. By shrinking the circle enough, by introducing a strong enough scalar field, you can bring this to the point where all three are positive, and that coincides with the stable sector. This is work done analytically by Alan Rendell. Okay, so any questions at this point? Please feel free to interrupt me whenever I say anything that's just wrong or you don't understand. Okay. So, some preliminaries. Let me introduce the Ashtagard variables. We're working in a phase space described by a densitized triad and the extrinsic curvature. We're going to assume this densitized triad is invertible all the way up to the singularity. These variables describe simple Poisson algebra. The Poisson bracket between E and H gives you a bunch of deltas. And we're going to define gamma to be the connection compatible with this densitized triad. So let D be the derivative compatible with the spatial free metric on a slice. This naturally defines for you a connection compatible with E. And in these variables, we can write down what the scalar, vector, and Gauss constraints are. Okay? So this right here at the bottom is general relativity. Okay, this is the 3+1 decomposition. Everybody happy with that? Any questions? Yes?
So the determinant of E never becomes zero in your approach, or you're assuming it's never zero?
We are going to assume that the determinant of E, or equivalent to the determinant of the spatial free metric, will go to zero at the singularity. But all the way along the approach, it will not be zero. Okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a 3+1 decom, I'm going to foliate our space-time by leaves on which we have a free metric, and it's only on the very limiting leaf of which we hit the singularity of the free metric the determinant will go to zero. Okay? So let's motivate this truncation, and quote for this is ignorance is bliss. What can we ignore? Okay? So the question is, what derivatives are we going to say are negligible? When I say the term spatial derivatives are negligible, the first question you should be asking is, what spatial derivatives, and spatial derivatives of what? There was a previous attempt, and a great deal of success, actually, made in the scale-invariant approach of Bugler, Els, Van Els, Wainwright, Ellis, etc., in which they decided that we see these variables that blow up, we should divide them by the trace of the extrinsic curvature. The trace of the extrinsic curvature also blows up in these singularities, and so by dividing by this trace, we find variables that actually tend to zero or are bounded at the singularity themselves. Therefore, let's try and express a theory in terms of these variables, these well-bounded variables, and ignore derivatives of the form given here. Okay? This got a great deal of support from numerical simulations by people like David Garfinkel, Beverly Berger, Franz Pretorius, Wojciech Lin. There's a whole sort of little cottage industry of doing numerical simulations with this system. And they see that this behavior is borne out in a full simulation of general space-time, so see as we evolve towards a singularity, you see the behavior is supported. Now, the problem that we have is...
So what do they do? Do they compare the truncated evolution with the full guy? Or?
No, what they do is they do the full guy. They go all the way, they start off with some data on a leaf, they go all the way towards a singularity, and then they calculate what these values are at each step, and they find they've got converging to zero.
So they check the boundedness.
Yeah, they check the boundedness. They check that these derivatives shrink fast enough that they tend to zero faster than every other term in the equation. Okay.
Is there a preferred way to take a time derivative in this setting? Do they take the constant? Where is the time derivative?
So they do a normally what you'll do is you will do either a constant mean curvature slicing or you'll do an inverse mean curvature slicing. And one or the other, they go back and forth between the two because each have their advantages and disadvantages when you're doing numerical code. But I think the current favorite of that way of doing it is you do a constant mean curvature slice because you know k is a constant on each slice, and they use this as that time, as their time evolution.
You can really do it.
Yes,
they
can really do it. I mean, they can do this. I mean, particularly normally what you do is you start off with a Gaudi or a GT model, and you do information on that on a surface there, and then you evolve. But people like Garvin would have been able to develop techniques to do a full thing. Again, it's in very, very limited capacity. This is for very, very simple perturbations away from, you know, they normally just do a cosine perturbation or something away from being perfectly homogeneous and isotropic, for example. Does that answer your question? Okay. So, a problem we have when we're looking for a quantum theory is that, broadly speaking, it's very difficult to quantize, to put a hat to, basically, on K inverse, okay? Unless you've got a good team and trick hanging around, you have a lot of trouble putting, making a quantum form, making an operator bar out of K inverse. But fortunately for us, this is something we notice, is that the densitized triad itself has similar properties to dividing by the trace of the extrinsic curvature. And that is that as we go to the singularity, we find that the determinant of the three metric goes to zero. So when things like k root q remain bounded, k blows up, root q must therefore go to zero. And so we want to say that we're going to take negligible derivatives to be a form, a densitized triad contracted with a derivative acting on what we want to say is a scalar. Okay? So things to take out of here is you have to be careful about what derivatives you're going to say are negligible, and you also have to be careful about derivatives of what variables you would say are zero. For example, if I said that derivatives of the triad itself were negligible, I would end up just with a Bianchi 1 solution, and I would miss all the interesting physics. Okay, so let's introduce these BKL-motivated variables. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the extrinsic curvature, and we're going to take the spatial curvature, and we're going to contract them with these densitized triads. Okay? And the main sort of information is given on the left-hand side here. It's in these two things. These parts are really just for the bookkeeping. They make the algebra simple. All we're doing is taking away a trace multiplied by a delta function. And what we're also going to do is we're going to define a new derivative operator. Okay? This derivative is a densitized triad contracted with the old derivative. And I want to tell you that this is a derivative operator. It's linear and it's Leibniz. However, it doesn't naturally define a connection. Okay? There's no sort of easy way to make a connection out of this guy. And so, although it is a derivative operator, it might not be something we're used to using. For example, if you're going to do evolution of the full theory, you have to evolve your derivative. Yeah, if you put a D dot on top of the D, it's not necessarily zero. Okay? Now notice that these P and C variables I've introduced are densities with only internal indices. Now this is something that came as a bit of a shock to us, because we managed to write then the constraints and the equations of motion for full general relativity in terms of densitized scalars as far as spatial derivatives are concerned. Okay? These have no space-like indices. They only have internal indices. Okay? All right. And yeah, to me, this was a huge shock. I mean, the fact that we managed to work a theory in which this happened was kind of surprising. And it was a wonderful thing when it happened. And one small note is that we do modify the vector constraint by contracting it with this triangle, okay, in order to get things of this form. Now, the kernel of this modified vector constraint, the original vector constraint, are exactly the same on the slices where E is non-degenerate. Okay? So all the way up to the singularity. And since when we want to motivate this from quantum gravity, we only really want to get to the Planck regime and say, okay, at this point classical relativity is broken down, we say that this is good enough. Okay. So let's talk about what the conjecture is then for us. And so that's a quote from Samuel Johnson.
Maybe you're going to describe more these equations. No?
Yeah, we'll describe what these equations are.
So presumably, are these equations not singular when you go to the singular ones in the usual variables?
Classically, they're singular.
What?
Classically, they are singular.
So they are even in that variables?
There's even none of the,
you multiply by dt, like you said, at the singularity, nothing goes up anymore? Or in that sense, you see, can I just continue then? Suppose I don't know what you just told me to do, which is fine. But just as a matter of exercise, I say, let me just.
So these actually do remain well defined into the degenerate sector of E. Okay, so when the root cube tends to go to zero, so when E becomes degenerate itself. Okay, these equations do remain well defined there.
So then they might evolve to a one where it's another, you know, they might evolve from this degenerate sector and give me the other side, of it.
You could do this, but basically what the assumption we're making though is that we have a time slicing on which our limiting leaf. Okay, so this is the lattice goes to infinity, or minus infinity. The time variable, goes to infinity or minus infinity, is where the singularity exists. And so to actually evolve through here, we would need to go past infinity. So we can't do any evolution.
You're obliged to take the okay. It's
going to be a requirement. Basically, it comes out when you do the full equation motion, don't just have P and C, you also have the lattice and so on. And this is part of the setup. This is what comes out of your inverse P curvature flow, or your mean curvature flow. It has to accentuate to something. It doesn't have to be a perfect mean curvature flow, but as a product, it has to work.
Well, because you take a mean curvature flow, you could take another flow.
You could take another flow,
Where you might, okay.
Where you might have different behavior, but you have to be. Again, you have to be very, very careful about what you're doing with mm-hmm. lattice and shift mm-hmm. because yes, these can blow up and you just lost everything.
But in your case, why can't you take asymptotic extension? Or why can't you find one?
Asymptotic extension of what?
Sorry. Like once you reach this in your clock, once you reach minus infinity or infinity, it's just your choice of clock.
Yeah, it is a choice of clock. The reason being that if you change the clock, you change the lattice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if your lattice in your new clock is blowing up, then you can't do anything. Can't say anything about it. Right? You have an ill-defined system at infinity.
Mm-hmm.
Or equivalently, if you take the opposite flow, you end up with a zero, and so you just end up getting to the slice where the evolution says, you stay here, you stay here, you stay here.
Are you saying that there's no choice of clock that will stay regular, or that you just look at one which becomes?
I don't believe that there is a choice of clock in which this will stay regular all the way through the singularity.
You have some argument for that?
This is a sort of a technical point.
Okay, maybe we can. When it comes, I don't think you have expressed equations.
Yeah. So, I mean, if I don't answer that by the end, please feel free to yell at me until I do. So, our form of the conjecture in terms of these variables are going to be these derivatives of P and C and the lattice go to zero sufficiently fast as we approach a singularity. And by the term sufficiently fast, I mean that wherever we see them in an equation, there are going to be other terms that completely dominate. Okay? As a side note, this actually implies that C becomes symmetric. It's just a little integration by parts, you can do a couple of lines. Okay?
Should I be worried that one guy is a double density, whereas another guy is a scalar?
Largely speaking, it's not actually going to be a problem. But if you look, I mean, we have this underdensity on the lattice itself. That means we're dividing by square root of Q. And so this is going to be, I mean, this would be a problem, for example, on the slice where Q goes to zero. You know, if you pick a normal lattice equal to one, this is going to tend to your other lattice blowing up. And so this brings us back to the problem we were talking about a moment ago. Okay, so we're going to make the assumption that P, C, and N remain bounded as we approach the singularity. Now, this is borne out with the Bianchi cosmologies. In fact, this is borne out in FRW cosmologies, for example. And so this is a sort of a fairly valid assumption to be making at this point. And we're going to make the conjecture then that solutions to the full equations of motion, so solutions to the PDEs that describe general relativity, are well approximated, near the singularity by solutions to the truncated equations, so to the ODEs we're going to want to take. Okay? This is what we're going to take our conjecture to be. Yeah.
What do you mean with well approximated?
Right, yeah, this is an excellent question. What we mean by well approximated is that we mean every solution, so for every solution that there is to the full equations of motion, there exists a solution to the truncated equations of motion, such that for all well-defined variables, you can define an epsilon such that the difference between the two will go to zero as we approach the singularity. Okay? So we're not going to say that they all are exactly this, but that you can always come up with one sufficiently close. And again, I mean, this is somewhere I'm going to run away and hide behind again and again, but the Planck regime is where we're aiming for here. Okay, yeah.
If I understand right, a lot is implicit in that statement because solutions to the partial differential equations where there are no spatial derivatives include solutions which are not differentiable, which are not continuous.
Yeah, there is a lot in this statement. I mean, absolutely. We are taking this conjecture. We aren't in any way sort of assuming proof.
Right, but I guess what would be nice here is to have a statement as to what is the mathematical setting. That is, are we still in? We might have been originally in a setting of C infinity functions. Are we still in a setting of C infinity functions? Are we in a setting of C zero functions? That is, that now I can invest lots of solutions to the ordinary differential equations, in which are totally, non-nice. You know, not continuous, not differentiable, etc.
Yeah, you will be. In fact, you can introduce complete discontinuities with these things. The idea is because we've killed these spatial derivative terms that points stop communicating one with another. Okay, so they have no knowledge of what's going on nearby, and so differentiability, continuity is completely thrown away here. You can have a completely discontinuous evolution into the singularity.
So I guess I'm still looking for a more precise statement in the form of the solutions to the full equations are presumably C infinite. And what do I mean by
the singularity is very hard to say.
No, but if I'm close to the singularity
close.
So the conjecture holds, I'm saying that a C infinity solution to the full equations is approximated by a solution to the truncated equations, which are still C infinity or which are not C infinity anymore.
Right. So I mean, this is. Yeah. So let me see. Got some chalk. Okay. So we want to say that you've got some function, say, and you've got this, nice smooth function, and we're going from. Going from one slice to the next, and it's staying nice and smooth and so on. Okay, you have the C infinity function. What we want to say is that we're going to take this function, and we're going to approximate it by one at which there's no communication between space-like separated points. So we're going to approximate it by something that looks like this.
No, but that doesn't look like a function, because you haven't given its value,
Right, so what I'm meaning here is that this is defined everywhere, except for the point here, point x and point x prime here, they have no way of communicating with one another.
Right. So generic functions with no conditions are not continuous. So generic continuous functions are discontinuous at every point, and they're really wild objects.
Yeah.
They're discontinuous at every point. They have no derivatives at every point. Is the claim, but nonetheless, they will be. An infinity of such things which are solutions to truncated equations.
Yes. So the point here is that these lie within these.
Yes.
Okay? So if we find solutions to all of these, we've got all of this.
Yes, but now is the statement that for every one over there, there's one over there that well approximates it?
Yes.
Okay, but not the reverse.
Not the reverse. Oh,
okay.
No, not that. If you give me something that looks like a delta function, there's nothing over here. And so, yeah, there'll be a series over here. There'll be one here for everything. This map is on two, but not one.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Sorry to take the time.
No. Questions? Okay, so we're going to say these solutions are well approximated. Okay, any more questions at this point?
Now you're going to give the justification for that, or you're...
This is the conjecture that's
going
to be one.
There
is analytical work done in this area by people like Lars Anderson and Ellen Randall. who do a very similar thing. They've been able to prove this in the case of a strong enough, as in conjugate momentum bigger than a quarter, I believe, scalar field. But to do this fully, this is still conjecture. There's numerical evidence for this, but there's no proof.
So in your talk, you're not going to justify
that. I'm not going to justify that. I'm taking this as a conjecture.
So you're going to talk about the truncated dynamics?
Yeah, I will talk about the dynamics of the truncated system.
So then maybe I have a question.
Yes.
At this stage, which in a sense is related to this question, which is a conceptual question about this big here. So, which, if I understand, you start from the full equation, then you look at it at them in the right variables, and then you can find some justification that in the full equation, maybe some terms are negligible.
Yeah.
That's I understand. And then you want to make the next step to go back and say, well, let's look at the truncated evolution. So far, it's fine with me, but it seems to me that in the logic, I'm waiting for the next argument. The next argument would be, in this truncated version, is my initial assumption verified? That is, my initial assumption was that if I do the evolution, the space derivative is negligible compared to the time derivative. So now that I move to the truncated version, you see, I'm waiting for the things, okay, fine, you know, is this truncated version satisfying that assumption? And the problem I have is the following, is that in the truncated version, the points are decoupled. And the system of each point, if I take homogeneous topology, is a chaotic system.
Yes.
So what does that mean? It means that if I take two points which have a space-like difference, delta x, it blows up exponentially with time. Therefore, the right?
So
we should wait because this is, you said this is the key question. So you're going to answer that concern.
I will.
If it blows up with time exponentially, therefore my initial assumption is not satisfied
absolutely
anymore, and I will
hopefully get to this.
Okay. So,
this stage,
good.
If not, I will
good.
Take you up
okay,
a great
okay.
Later and explain.
Okay.
Okay. So let's see. Where are we? Okay. So yeah. So we can obtain the truncated theory by just chopping off all these derivative terms. And what I want to tell you is that this subspace in which this is true forms a fixed subspace of the full phase space. So that is, if you find, if you are on this fixed subspace, you never leave it. Now, this is a good thing. If you knew you were on this subspace and you left it again, this would be a terrible thing. How the heck can you claim that this is going to be an asymptotic approach if you find that you can move my way again? However, it's a bad thing because if you aren't on it to begin with, you're never actually going to get them. So the conjecture is that we become tangential to evolution on this fixed subspace theory. The evolution in the full phase space asymptotes to being parallel to evolutions on this fixed subspace. Okay? So again, we can just find out what our Poisson brackets are for the truncated system by taking the full Poisson brackets and taking off the derivative parts. And then finally, we get also the constraints. This is the truncated theory itself in terms of C and P. Okay, we have the scalar, the modified vector, the Gauss constraints. Gauss constraint tells you P symmetric, we've already made C symmetric. The scalar constraint looks, and the vector constraint itself, they look symmetric in C and P, and in fact they are.
Can you just record C with the connection?
C comes from contracting the connection with a densitized prior. P comes from contracting the extrinsic curvature with
an aspect. And C is symmetric because?
C is symmetric. It comes out of setting these derivatives equal to zero. So
because of the assumption.
Because of my assumption.
Okay.
And so the scalar constraint, although it looks symmetric in CMP, the Poisson brackets aren't symmetric in CMP, and so we see this is how the two variables split up from having this symmetry between. And we notice, again, we've written the constraints only in terms of C and P. There's no densitized triad here. There's no spatial indices here. Everything just has internal indices. Okay? That's, for me, again, this is a big shock. This was not something we expected. This was certainly not something we put in by hand. This happened naturally. You know, I did this calculation like 25 times to make sure it was true because, you know, it was kind of a big surprise to me. Okay. So from this, we can get the truncated equations of motion. again, although I mean this is the algebra from there, but what I want to take away from this is we get equations of motion that are quadratic in the basic variables. Okay? C and P both have quadratic evolution, and you'll notice C and P evolve all by themselves. There's no connection to E here. E you can evolve on top of this system, but C and P you don't need to know E for. So if you give me a spatial slice, you give me a densitized triad, an extrinsic curvature on that slice, I can form for you C and P, and then evolve C and P quite happily without knowing anything else. Okay? And then on top of that, I can come back at the end of the day when I've done this entire evolution and find out what E would be. Okay? Now there is a consistency check you can do at this point, and that's illustrated here. You can take the full constraints, make the reduction by throwing away these derivatives to find reduced constraints, and then find equations of motion by taking Poisson brackets. Or you can find the full equation of motion and then throw away the derivatives. And what happens is this process is commutative. You end up at the same theory, whichever way you go around this. And again, this is a big check, and you have to do this. If this did not work, you would not have a well-defined truncation. Yes.
So the vector constraints now commute with each other?
The vector constraints in these terms will commute, yes.
Will commute with each other.
Yeah.
So...
I can check that. Okay.
So they no longer generate spatial diffeomorphisms?
No, because there's nothing spatial going on here, basically. There's no communication between space on separated points.
So what is their algebra? Is it just recommuting constraints?
Yeah.
Can you show back the constraints?
The constraints look like this. The scalar gives you something. Basically, the Gauss-Gauss remains exactly as you expect it. The Gauss vector gives you a rotation as well. And the vector-vector, I believe, reduces to zero. But again, this is in the paper. I could be misquoting. But I should definitely...
No longer generates diffeomorphisms.
But it won't generate diffeomorphisms in the full sense because, again, we have thrown away... we have thrown away all knowledge of other points at each point. Okay? We have reduced GR from being a PDE of a massive, a full manifold, basically, to being evolution at individual points.
Okay. And S with S gives you just zero, so S more, S doesn't give you V anymore.
Yeah. Okay. So what we can do is we can then fix the gauges. Okay. By gauge. Yeah. Sorry.
Did you what happened to the laps? Some sense the laps is not there in the beginning. Sorry, the shift.
The shift. We've set the shift equal to zero for this. Again, this is just bookkeeping to make the slides simple. We can do this all with the shift involved, but the equations get longer. But nothing qualitatively changes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we can fix gauges by we say that P and C are both symmetric, 3x3 matrices. They commute. This comes out of the vector constraint. And so it tells us we can simultaneously diagonalize them. So this is a huge step. We've taken GR, we've made a few simplifications to it, we've thrown away spatial derivatives, and we've ended up with a theory described just in terms of 2 3x3 symmetric matrices that commute. And so we did a natural thing, we diagonalized them, and we end up with 6 degrees of freedom, the eigenvalues of P. And the Poisson algebra between these eigenvalues is incredibly simple. P with P is C with C is 0, P with C is 2C. Now notice that these are not canonically conjugate variables. You could form a canonically conjugate variable by taking 1/2 x to be, say, 1/2 the log of C, and then you would have a conjugate pair. However, again, this just makes the bookkeeping more difficult to do. It just makes things difficult, I guess, so we just leave it like this.
Is this a demonstration that C or P should be positive
somewhere? No, there's no...
Where is the node degeneracy? Nowhere?
Nowhere. So P or C could be 0. Or negative.
So where is the singularity? How do you see it?
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to find that our constraints, that we still have a scalar constraint, okay? Mm-hmm. And so the p's are going to be defining our extrinsic curvature, and so the extrinsic curvature eventually, although the p's remain bounded because we've contracted within the term of the 3 metric, this is still going to blow up and still missing the singularity. Okay?
In the phase space or any constraints? You're going to describe that. Yes.
Sorry?
You're going to describe
that. Yeah, I'll describe that. Okay, so we have the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay, scalar constraint comes back. Again, looks fairly simple. Okay? So we have evolution equations. Now, again, when we stick away from these evolution equations, these time derivative equations, is that they are just simple quadratics. Okay? If you notice, C1, C2, C3 equals 0. Any one of them equals 0 forms a fixed surface. Okay? So if I set C1 to 0, it's always 0. And P1 will remain constant. Okay? And so what we can do is we can really make this canonical transformation if we want to by taking logs. If they were fixed to always, if they weren't fixed, C could cross 0, you could just take its log, log is all fine. But fortunately for us, this splits the phase space up into octaves. Okay? C1 equals 0 forms a plane, C2 0, C3 0 forms a plane. And if you're in one of these octaves, you're stuck there. And these C's effectively parameterize the Bianchi class A models. Okay? All the C's are 0, you're going to get a Bianchi 1. One of the C's is positive, you get a Bianchi 2. All three C's are positive, you get a Bianchi 9. One of the C's is negative, 2 positive, you get a Bianchi 8, etc., etc. Okay? And so we have an evolution for all the Bianchi models. And so this is why we say it's going to give us the mixed extended networks. Okay, so let's look at the dynamics of the reduced system.
Does the definition yes. Mixed masters means that just involving all the Bianchis together?
Or? Yeah, there's sort of debate in the community as to what mixed master means. Generally, what people have taken to mean in the past is you take a Bianchi 9 solution, and you see that a Bianchi 9 solution is well approximated, again, in the sense I spoke about earlier, by a series of Bianchi 1 and 2 Bianchi 2 transitions. But recently, people have also said, well, hang on, Bianchi 8 is completely different from this. There's a wonderful, it's 80 pages long, so it's a bit of a slog, but a paper by Hans Rickström that came out fairly recently in which he proves all these things about how the dynamics is going to flow for Bianchi 9 and a little bit about Bianchi 8. And you find that, basically, in terms of R variables, you find that one of these C's eventually goes to 0, so you go from Bianchi 9 to Bianchi 6H, and then eventually you get the other C going to 0, so you go back to Bianchi 2. So you see this whole sort of evolution, but it takes a heck of a long time, and there's no simple way of seeing this. You have to go through quite a lot of mathematics to get there. Okay. So here we have the dynamics of the reduced system. We can see these dynamics both analytically and numerically. Now, analytically, what you can do is you can start off with a Bianchi 1 solution, all these C's 0, and then perturb it slightly. You can make one of them slightly non-zero, and you see it goes through a Bianchi 2 transition and back to another Bianchi 1. And so what we see over here is we see an evolution in which we have three fairly generic values of P to begin with and three very close to zero values of C. Okay? And what we see is the P's are roughly constant for a while, and then one of these C's grows and then drops back down. Meanwhile, the corresponding P transitions. And you can show it's always going to be the largest in magnitude value of P that takes a transition. And you can show that it's going to cross the second largest and so on. And you get this evolution behavior going on again.
Did you start it from C equal to 0?
C very close to 0. So all the C's are 0.00.
Just for simplicity?
This is because this is what we can do analytically. Numerically, you can go well away from this. And in fact, numerically, we had to, get to write our own ODE solvers and everything, in which we did this iterative Picard algorithm. We used the constraint as a check for whether or not we were staying close to the phase space and we were staying on the right evolution and so on. But you can move well away from here. And in fact, I will talk about that if I have time in a few minutes.
So here, there's maybe what I was referring before. Right? So whether you look at P on one point and P doesn't change, but the P at the next point suddenly transit.
Yes.
So, I was assuming that they were constant, but then the dynamics tells me they are not.
That one of them will transition slightly before the one next one.
Yeah, so that at some point the space derivative becomes absolutely huge there, and my initial assumption is that.
Well, remember that these P's themselves are being suppressed. Okay, the curvatures themselves, the derivatives. The derivatives of the P's are being suppressed by a factor of square root of the determinant of the 3 metric, which itself is going to 0.
But here, are you talking about I thought you were thinking about the CI and the PI, which are the variables you use with snow.
Yes.
Everything is in terms of this variable.
Yeah.
And when you talk about derivative, you talk about derivative of these variables.
Yeah.
So you don't have to wait for the tool.
So maybe go ahead.
Yeah, maybe go ahead. Okay.
Yeah, and so let's see. With Chasma Map, I will come back to, that, and we'll talk about this because this is what you're asking about, really, is where does the system break? Where do we see that this happens? So what you can do is you can give me a slice on which we have broadly homogeneous data. Okay? We have a slight inhomogeneity, and we see that these transitions do happen in P, okay, and they happen over time, and you find that if you have a slight inhomogeneity, what you find is, in fact, that if we look at this, along this one axis, we have the evolution of time, we have a slight inhomogeneity going on this axis, and this is the value of the field C.
Sorry, like this is a space, can you...
Okay, this axis maps time, so we have time evolutions going along here.
Okay, this is space.
This is space.
And the height is the measure of P?
Yeah, the measure of C in this case.
C.
Okay. And so what we see is that we have an evolution that does go through a transition, but nearby points also go through a transition very, very close to the same time.
If I was plotting the... You ever plot where you plot the space derivative of the lines? Wouldn't you get like a bunch of delta function peaks, which is what I worry about?
No, you find that in fact this actual space derivatives along here are incredibly small and smooth.
But not
everywhere up to here.
Yeah.
This is what we call a spike. This is a generic feature that happens about the points where C is equal to zero.
Does the dynamic drive you towards C equal to zero?
The dynamics do drive us towards C equal to zero, but if you notice, this is where we have C is above zero, and here we have C is below zero. What I was telling you about before is that C equals to zero is it's a plane that you cannot cross. Okay? So if you can cross this in space, you get a spike like this, but if you start off in a region where all the C's are all positive all the time, okay, so you give me an initial slice on which all the C's are one sign, you won't get this behavior. Or at least we don't see it numerically, and analytically we believe we won't see it.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, physically, what does C zero correspond? Is that like the spatial
curvature? C equals zero, C corresponds to the spatial curvature, the gamma connection on the slice.
It's the intrinsic. So maybe what you're telling me, something that I find convincing is that you might have a way, suppose you have a way to characterize the places where your approximation is not true. So what would be nice is that if you had a way to, let's say, compute the density of such spikes, and then argue that this density is not growing over time or it's staying low or whatever. Because, that would address really this conceptual problem around the whole BKN logic, because you see, there's a gap in the logic.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is an egg, and you're assuming something that the dynamics breaks, and then you want to see, most naturally might break, and you want to see that it's under control.
Yeah, so we are making the assumption that we're on one side or another of this. We aren't actually at this point. These points are very few and far between.
Oh, so can you characterize the type of initial data for which...
Yeah, this is equals zero. C1 equals zero.
But if I give you a type of initial data, can you just, I don't know, compute a functional that tells me, okay, here's the number of spike I'm going to develop.
The truncated system, you could just do this. Other than what C is at every point, and the points at which you get zeros, that's exactly where C becomes degenerate, that's what you can have these spikes.
Okay, so if you have initial data with positive curvature everywhere, that's like having C positive, or?
Positive intrinsic curvature, yeah.
Maybe let's go through the rest of it.
Okay.
What is my time? I think you have a lot more to say.
I do. I'll cut this short because we are running out of time, but we find that these Chasma solutions are parameterized by one parameter u that I was telling you before. So if you're on the Chasma circle, you have one value of u. If you are slightly off the Chasma circle, you find you're in a Bianchi, approximately Bianchi 1 spacetime, which goes through a Bianchi 2 transition to another Bianchi 1 spacetime, again parameterized by about u. And we see that there is this map, which we call the Chasma map, where as we go through a transition, these U's step down by one every time. Except for when U is less than 2, in which case it goes over to 1 over U minus 1. And we know this analytically, we've done this for slight perturbations, and we know this numerically. We see here, it starts off at about 3 and an eighth, goes to 2 and an eighth, goes to 1 and an eighth, jumps up to 8.
U is the unknown, or what is the...
U is, yeah, so if you have a... if you have this Kepler solution, K1 plus K2 plus K3 equals 1, then you can say that one of them, let's just pick K1, is U over 1 plus U plus U squared. K2 is 1 minus U over 1 plus U plus U squared. And K3 is U into U minus 1, I believe it is, plus U plus U squared. And so it's the one degree of freedom that parameterizes where you are on the Gaussian circle. So we have this sort of circle, and there's a U that tells you we're here. Okay? And so we can see what happens in these transitions, and we find there's this sort of discrete map going on. And this is sort of really cool, because it's a really, it looks like a very simple thing to look at. We just have simple rules. It steps down by one, or it goes to 1 over U minus 1.
Yeah. All this, so this is like time?
This is like going on in time, and we see these big spiky things are where we go through a transition, and then we're in a Bianchi 2 where we go through...
How is it related to the other variable? When I transit, do I change C?
So when you transit, you will change one of these K's.
The K's and the C's?
The K's are like the P's.
K's are like the P's.
Yeah, because it relates to the experience of curvature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's not a direct thing, you're going to have to contract.
Mm-hmm. And so this transition will look kind of separately on any point at different times.
Yes. And so, yeah, we see these, and these flat parts are where we're in the Bianchi variations. Okay, or very close to, I should say. Okay, so the Kazan map itself, it appears simple, but finding actual cycles in this is very difficult. Although it looks like a very simple system, it's actually very hard to solve. You have to get into number theory, and you have to do continued fractions if you want to actually find what all these cycles are going to look like. If you want to say, okay, how do I get a repeating thing? And out of nowhere, we find that the golden mean shows up, for example, the cycle of length 1. Take 1 plus root 5 over 2, you subtract 1 of it, it goes to its reciprocal, you get back to itself. Likewise, root 2 has length 2. You take 1.41, take 1 off it to 0.41, take its reciprocal to 2.41, take one up and you're back to 1.41 again. But generally, closed cycles are very rare. Mostly, you get this, what we said, is chaotic behavior. Okay? And for a given measure, you spend a long time at high U. Now, U is like a measure of the anisotropy. And if you think about it, if U is a very is 1.00001 or something, you're going to then jump up to some incredibly large number and slowly step down one value, one integer at a time. Okay, so it looks like you should spend a long time at high value, high anisotropies. However, if you aren't in a high anisotropy to begin with, and you believe there's only a finite number, a very small number of these transitions between the scale we're at now and the Planck regime, then you say that, well, maybe we don't actually go anywhere near a high value U. Again, that's something you just have to calculate, you have to look at.
So, do I interpret correctly your result if I imagine the following things when I approach the singularity? So you told me, let me go to a region where C is kind of small. So let's say, you know, intensity curvature is like a piece of a sphere. That's crazy. But now, okay, but you showed the map only for the DEC. But now the P, which is the extra curvature, you know, is going to be the one guy. Which means that at some point I have a piece of, it's a homogeneous space. Imagine it's flat in some sense.
Yeah.
But then it's folded. It's kinky. It's kinky at you know, kind of lots of space. And the density of this kink is going to, right, so when I approach, I think in 2 plus 1 people have a description which is exactly like that, where you see it's really a piece of flat space, a singularity. And so that's really a picture of the singularity. I can approach it being C constant, that's okay, but the excessive curvature will be a wild beast that we agree on. That the you know, the surface will fold like that here, and then unfold like that here, and there will be, you know, network of kinky singularities.
Now, I believe
if I was in 2 plus 1, it's easier to picture.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I believe this roughly shows what you were talking about. Here we have a value like what I was talking about before. This is an evolution along the C is equal to 0 line. You see the P is constant all the way along.
Where's time and space?
So time runs this way, space runs this way. Okay. And so we see that on either side, though, of this C is equal to 0, we see a transition. And we see a transition to almost identical values on either side of this. And so there's this one point, you're absolutely right, there's one point at which a spike forms. Okay? But on either side of it, everything is smooth. And if we were to sort of excise this one point from our space-time and glue it back together again, we wouldn't see it at all. However,
is it
this,
a one point or one string?
Well, it depends on your initial data. I mean, if you give me a whole sort of slew of the manifold where C is 1 is equal to 0, then you will find that whole area.
I'm saying that because in 2 plus 1, you canceled exactly the solution. What you see is that because the excessive curvature is a one form, what happens is that these the bending singularity are aligned along lines, and then there are meeting points there. So they form like a triangulation, in some sense, that you can, you know, unfold in that space, something like that. So,
okay.
So maybe at this stage you cannot say
that.
But you see, there's the questions of what is the codimension. Okay, if you're saying there are, let's say, now I'm in free space, but I don't know. If you're telling me that the codimension of this kink is 2, then in some sense you put my worry, that's what you're trying to say here, then you put my worry back into the dustbin and I'm happy.
Yeah.
But if there are codimension 1, you know, which they are in 2 plus 1, then I think we have room for more arguments.
I have no knowledge at this point.
This is
something I would like to look at. We aren't there yet. But what we do see, I mean, what I want to tell you is this is where the theory is telling you that it itself is broken. Okay? This is telling you we have spatial derivatives here. And so we should have some back reaction to that. Okay? But the fact that these spikes form is seen in the full theory. Okay? So the formation of these things is correct. But the resolution, the back reaction of them, is not. Okay? And so that's the physics we are missing. And that is stuff that I would absolutely love to put back in. I would love to have a way of doing this, since I'm out of time.
Otherwise, a lot of this kind of go, why don't you go a little bit further?
Okay. So what I should also say is that we can add, we can add a massless and homogeneous scalar field to our system, very simply. Okay, all that happens is you're going to alter the scalar constraint. Okay, you're going to add this conjugate momentum of the scalar field to the scalar constraint. And we see, both again, analytically and numerically, that for values of this this scalar field of momentum bigger than 1/4, we see that these transitions, these Bianchi 2 stages stop, Bianchi 1 becomes stable, and everything just revolves nicely forever as a Bianchi 1 with a scalar field. Okay? So, again, this is something inspired by loop quantum gravity, and I would say he's using a scalar field as a clock. If you give me a big enough scalar field, I could say that we're going to end up at Bianchi 1, and then maybe we can just look at quantizing Bianchi 1. However, for low values, you do get this transition still. Okay? It's just they take a lot longer to start transitioning. Okay, so let me talk about the future work. And everyone, you know, I've got this system, I have a Hamiltonian that's quadratic, I have a simple Poisson algebra. It's a really sort of fun toy to play with, and you can do all kinds of fun stuff with it. I mean, I've just told you about the Kasner map and, you know, doing some simple numerical evolutions, but there's a whole lot more sort of work to be done here. I'd love to look at putting this thing on a lattice, for example. I'd love to look at sort of saying, okay, we have all these points, all these spatially separated points that aren't communicating with each other through derivatives, but could we reintroduce some kind of coupling that approximates this, which is easier to quantize than just a straight derivative, but in itself will reproduce some of the behavior. If so, can we get towards an inhomogeneous model from this? I think there's a lot of work to be done there for introducing it. They're very interesting. So yeah, I'd love to quantize the Hamiltonian we've got. I'd love to Wheeler-DeWitt quantize it. I'd love to loop quantize it, ideally, because this is where the interesting stuff will be. I mean, if we don't see singularity resolution now, we can say, okay, singularity resolution is not generic. Bianchi 1, Bianchi 2 don't resolve singularities. So obviously the program has flaws in that sense. But if we do see singularity resolution, we can say, okay, it looks a little more robust. It's on a slightly stronger footing. We still haven't done the full space time. There's still a lot of work to be done there, but this might be a good first step in some sense. Okay. Also, I'd like to look more at the flows on phase space. We say that there's this fixed subspace that we have on which these assumptions hold. It has a nice sort of flow structure on it through these Bianchi 1 and Bianchi 2 stages. But I'd like to look at flows on the full phase space and say, is this really an attractor? Are we really flowing towards this? Is there any way in which we can really understand the geometry of phase space with this fixed subspace in it? And also, I'd like to add different types of matter. So far, I've only added a stiff fluid and a homogeneous one at that. I'd like to try inhomogeneous fluids. I'd like to look at what happens if we have tilted fluids, for example, and various other things. I'd like to see what happens to the system there. And finally, yeah, there is a challenge here. Someone please go and prove this for me. I will buy you drinks. I stand behind that statement completely if anyone can prove that this is true.
Where do we get if we disprove it?
I think if you disprove it, you have to buy me drinks in consideration or something for wasting time in my life. Well, if actually, I mean, in all honesty, if you do disprove it, it would be a wonderful step too, because it would tell us where these assumptions are not borne out. It would give us a lot of information. I think there's still progress to be made even in a disproof or a counterexample. Okay, so the conclusion, and yeah, this is what you all came here for, but I held it to the end so you couldn't all leave early. So we have described the BKL conjecture in a Hamiltonian formulation with variables that I believe are well suited to quantization. It's become a system that's just simple and quadratic in all its constraints. It's got a really simple Poisson algebra. So we should have a really good shot to the quantization of the system. We have a consistent truncation of the full theory obtained by ignoring these derivative terms. And it does reproduce the expected mixed master behavior. We would love to quantize this. I mean, there are a couple of caveats because obviously we haven't done it yet and there is a lot of work to be done before we get there. Our constraints are in terms of C and P instead of just the connection of the triad. And so we need some clever way of writing these things in terms of velocities and fluxes. And so as a possible intermediate step, we will be looking at some sort of effective equations. Okay. And that's all I have to say, and thank you for your time.
Further questions?
What about numerical studying? Is this way of reformulating simplifying numerical work, or could simplifying numerical
work? Absolutely, yeah.
And why?
Okay, and why? Okay, so we have this truncated system. So what you can do is you can split the full Hamiltonian into H equals a point plus H derivatives, okay? In which this, we have the sort of the Hamiltonian system that we developed here, and here we want to reintroduce these derivative terms, okay? And so we have, we've already got the evolution for this part. Reintroducing this part, yeah, it's going to take a little bit of work, but calculating these derivatives should be fairly easy on a computer because you just evolve the 2 points. You say, what's the difference between them? What is this D operator here? We can do this. You know, this is certainly possible. And
is
this
easier than what's implemented now, the one we described in the beginning?
I believe it is. I believe it's significantly easier. Going to be significantly easier
because there the separation isn't that clean.
There the separation isn't so clean. Mm-hmm. Also, the evolution for these things are very difficult. I think they have to use Yukawa frames and they have to use all kinds of tricks in order to do their evolutions. I mean, I really should write code to do this, and it took a bit. It took a little bit of work, but I wrote it in MATLAB and it took me a couple of weeks. And, people doing this in the full theory, it takes them months and years and lifetimes to write the full code. So it's, I'm no accomplished computer scientist, but this was certainly possible to do. Also, because of the evolution system we've got, we take an evolution, we calculate the equations of motion, and then what we do is, after each time step, we check the scalar constraint. And we say, okay, has the scalar constraint been conserved to 1 part in 10 billion seconds? And if so, we accept that move. But if it hasn't been constrained, if it hasn't been preserved well enough, we reduce the time step and we recalculate. Okay? And so the system has built into it sort of a natural check of consistency, which again, I don't think is present in the other evolutions. I mean, there's masses of details on the numerical work I could talk about here, because you have to be very careful when you do this. The first thing I learned about computers is you have to be very careful when you deal with very big numbers, but you also have to be incredibly careful when you deal with very small numbers, because the difference for a computer between 1 part in 10 billion and zero, sometimes they don't know the difference.
So how do you check or verify that your numerical simulation is running correctly?
So again, what I do is I can calculate. Okay, I put in initial data that solves the scalar construction. Okay, I give it 5 of the initial variables it solves for 6. Okay, then I use the equations of motion I've obtained to move all 6 of these variables forward by an interval in time, recalculate the scalar constraint at this point. Okay, and then I compare the scalar constraint at this point to the scalar constraint at the initial time, and if they've deviated by a lot, I know I've broken my evolution. Whereas if they stay very, very close to being the same thing, I know that my evolution is probably well defined.
But can you check with some analytical expression in some regime?
We can put in initial data that's Bianchi 1 and solve it analytically and look at the numerics, for example. We can give it problems that we know analytic solutions to compare it to. In fact, I have a little graph of this somewhere. Here, but it doesn't display too well. But here what we have is a numerical evolution well away from the Bianchi 1 regime, okay? We're way in the anisotropic sector, we're way away from the Kasner circle here, we're a long way off, but the C values are plotted here, and this, yeah, again, it's a little hard to see. But what we see in red, say, there's two graphs together here. There's a red graph of a numerical simulation, and there's a yellow graph there of a by Siech functions. Now, these Siech functions are predicted to be the transitions we'll see in the Bianchi 2 ratio. You do the math. It takes you a few pages, you come up with it. It should approximate to a Siech. And I fit this with a sum of 3 Siech functions. And you see here that the red and the yellow are so close together, you can't even see the difference between them. Okay? So, to me, this indicates that this is a pretty good simulation. It looks like it's a very, very good approximation. But again, I am not a numerical relativist. They would probably laugh at my code if they saw it. So, I mean, if anyone has a much better understanding of this, I would love for them to work on the numerics with me.